Welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy. What you're about to hear was originally recorded and broadcast for Pythagoras's Trousers, a Radio Cardiff science show and podcast sponsored by EADS. You can hear the full show and listen to past episodes at pythagoras-trousers.co.uk.
Thanks, Reese. Well, this month I wanted to talk about Mars, but instead of looking at its glorious landscapes and the wonderful photo of its rocks, I wanted to look at it from a slightly different point of view. Two new missions have arrived there in the end of September, the Indian Mars Orbiter mission and NASA's MAVEN mission. Now, MAVEN is targeted specifically at Mars's atmosphere, and to find out what we know, I thought I'd talk to Dr. Peter Reed from the University of Oxford, who researches into Mars's atmosphere. And I began by asking Peter, what do we currently know about the atmosphere of the red planet?
Okay, well, Mars has at the moment a relatively thin atmosphere. It's composed mostly of carbon dioxide. The surface pressure on Mars is something like about 0.5% or so of what we're currently experiencing at the surface of the Earth. It's a very dry atmosphere and not a particularly hospitable one. But the interesting feature that we see from evidence on the surface is that the Martian atmosphere hasn't always been like this. So certainly if you look some 2 or 3 billion years or so ago, there are various features on the surface that indicate that liquid water almost certainly flowed on the surface of Mars. And there's no way that that could take place right now with the thin atmosphere that Mars currently has. So it must have had a much more hospitable and much denser atmosphere in the past. And so MAVEN's job is really to sort of try to find out some clues as to what happened to this very, you know, relatively hospitable atmosphere to result in the thin atmosphere that we now observe.
And that evidence for it once having been thicker is due to the stuff we see in the rock. So the Curiosity rover is there at the moment, trundling over the surface in Gale Crater, and there have obviously been previous missions, the Opportunity rover still going strong, and they've shown that the rocks were formed in the presence of water, and that must tell us a lot about the atmosphere itself.
Absolutely. So it certainly indicates that the conditions were certainly warmer on the surface of Mars than they are now, because that's at least one of the things that you need in order to sustain water. But not only that, but the basic pressure must have been higher in order to keep water actually liquid and not just simply evaporate directly from ice into vapor, which is what would happen over most of the Martian surface right now.
So if you took a glass of water to the Martian surface now and teleported it to the surface, it wouldn't exist. It would just turn straight into water vapor, right?
Almost certainly, or else it would freeze solid. The temperatures are sufficiently low that it would would easily freeze ice, freeze water to ice.
Now, we mentioned that there used to be water on the surface of Mars, and in fact we think there used to be oceans on Mars, seems to be the evidence for what's there, very, very large bodies of water. Clearly, when we look at Mars now, we don't see any water, and we've mentioned that the rocks were formed billions of years ago in the presence of this water on the surface. So Peter, where's the water gone?
Well, although you can't see any evidence now for liquid water present right now as we speak, nonetheless, there's still quite a lot of water in the Martian environment. You only need to look at the poles of Mars to see huge amounts of water ice. So Mars has quite prominent polar ice caps that are mostly composed of water ice. In fact, in the north polar ice cap, people have actually been able to measure using ground-penetrating radar measurements from the surface. We can actually measure that there are layers of ice 2 or 3 kilometers thick, and when you add that up across the whole of the Martian polar ice cap, that's as much ice as we now find in the Greenland ice cap on the Earth itself. So there's still quite a lot of water there, though not enough water to account for the oceans that we think might have been present in the very early stages of the Martian system. So this is still a kind of controversial area, but certainly there are still some scientists who believe that there was an ocean at one stage that was at least 500 meters thick and covering a pretty large fraction of the whole of the surface of Mars, and that's quite a lot of water. Now, as I say, we can account for some of it being locked up in frozen form in the polar ice caps, and there may also be some actually under the surface that sort of kind of soaked into the ground and then frozen. But exactly where all of this water has gone to is still a bit of an open question. So this again is something that we're hoping that MAVEN will shed some light.
And there's lots of other stuff we can tell from the rocks as well. So when the rocks are studied, they do contain essentially bubbles of the Martian atmosphere from when they were formed. So is that something that's being studied in detail?
Not in terms of actually studying at the Martian surface itself. One way that it is thought that you can actually get hold of samples of the very early Martian atmosphere, though, is through various kinds of meteorites. There are a certain class of meteorites that you can actually pick up on the Earth's surface that for various sort of geochemical reasons are believed to have originated on Mars, and some of these have little inclusions that have a little bit of trapped air inside of them. So that's certainly something that people have been studying for some time now in terrestrial laboratories. It's kind of remarkable that these things seem to have survived, but it's thought that they originated when a large meteor sort of hit the Martian surface. It basically sent various debris up into the air, and the escape velocity on Mars is sufficiently slow that some of these bits and pieces would have actually essentially left the Martian gravitational field and somehow or other found their way over to the Earth. It seems a remarkable story, but this seems to be a story that sort of hangs together, that at least the experts in meteorite science seem pretty convinced this is what happened.
And the advantage there is that you can take this meteorite into a fully blown lab here on Earth, and use the best instruments available on the planet to study it. Whereas the challenge is, the problem with that is that you don't know exactly where this rock came from, other than it came from Mars originally. What Curiosity,
right,
I suppose, does is it tells us it can study stuff there in where it is on the surface. It can study what's there in situ.
Absolutely. So you can really see the geological context of it and see where it lies, with respect to the strata in the rock and where it lies in the landscape.
Now what you're involved with the Curiosity mission, but you're not involved with the bits of it that are studying the rocks in detail, and you're not involved with the bits of that are taking the pictures of where it's going. You're involved with one of the other experiments on board. And tell us what your involvement there is.
Well, my involvement is with the weather station that's basically mounted on the Curiosity rover. So this is a set of instruments that were actually provided by a Spanish group, and they're basically there to measure the sort of temperature, pressure, humidity, and ideally the winds that they were hoping to measure. Essentially, as the Curiosity rover sort of slowly makes its way across the Martian surface, these instruments were there to essentially measure the weather systems as they went past. So that's my interest is then to sort of compare some of these measurements with some of our model predictions. So one of the things that we've been doing in my group is to develop essentially a weather and climate prediction model for the Martian atmosphere, and that can actually make perhaps a little bit overblown to say it's making weather forecasts directly for what Curiosity is going to see, but it can certainly predict the kind of average climate that we would expect the Curiosity rover to encounter. And so we're just beginning, we're right at the very early stages because we're only just starting to get our hands on some of the data. But we're starting to compare, what Curiosity is measuring in terms of certainly temperatures and pressure fluctuations and so on, compared with what our model is predicting.
So we have an understanding of how Mars's atmosphere behaves, or how we think it should behave from the models at least, and we know that it used to be very different. It used to be much thicker and much warmer. How does a planet lose its atmosphere?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's really what we hope MAVEN will shed some light on. So there are various ways in which a planet can can lose its atmosphere. The sort of obvious approach is just simply that at the very top of the atmosphere, where the pressure is very, very low, what happens is that the lower the pressure, basically the farther individual air molecules can actually move before they bump into other molecules. Some molecules are moving relatively slowly, but some are moving pretty fast. And some of them can actually, just through random chance, end up with having enough velocity to actually leave the gravity of the planet that's holding them. So that's the sort of very basic, sort of most elementary escape mechanism. But life gets interesting when you have a planet that either has a magnetic field or encounters essentially what the sun is spewing out. Magnetic fields can act to essentially trap charged particles at the very top of the atmosphere, and that can actually inhibit the loss of the atmosphere. But then you've got the solar wind, which are these very high energy charged particles racing towards the planet from the sun, and they can actually help to sort of strip out some of the particles from the atmosphere itself by various sort of complex processes. So that's essentially what MAVEN is going to be measuring, is essentially what the solar wind is doing now to the Martian atmosphere. The sort of magnetic angle is kind of interesting as far as Mars is concerned, because Mars essentially doesn't have a substantial magnetic field now. It's not like the Earth, which has this, you know, very powerful sort of dipole magnetic field, a bit like a bar magnet sort of going through the center of the planet, that kind of produces this beautiful sort of loopy magnetic field that envelops the whole planet. Mars, we think, probably once had such a field when it was very young planet. In maybe the first 500 million years of the existence of the planet, it's thought that it probably had a magnetic field that was a bit Earth-like. But Mars is much smaller than the Earth. It's about half the size of the Earth, and so it tends to cool down much more quickly. And so it's thought that if Mars has a metallic core, which is essentially where we think the Earth's magnetic field is generated, if Mars had such a core, then it probably cooled down rather too quickly and solidified and stopped moving around. And so that essentially more or less switched off the generation of its magnetic field. And so Mars no longer has a strong magnetic field, and so its interaction with the solar wind is a bit different to the Earth, and so something that we still don't fully understand in detail. And so that's what MAVEN is going to try and help us to understand better.
And of course, MAVEN's not going to produce pretty pictures like a lot of the missions have come from in the past. It's not got a pretty picture camera on it. So for that, we rely on the other orbiters that are there. So the Mars Orbiter mission from India, of course, which has just got there and is taking very wide field views of Mars.
So I believe, yes. I'm afraid I haven't actually seen very much yet from this mission, but it has a very different focus, and it's a much more sort of broad brush kind of focus, I believe, than the MAVEN mission. The MAVEN mission is pretty specialised.
And I guess that's something that happens when you're exploring a planet, another planet in the depth that we are with Mars. Eventually, instead of taking a mission that's going to do a lot of different things, you can take very specifically targeted missions and answer very, very specific questions that you might have. So I know there's a mission planned for a few years' time called InSight, which is going to measure the interior of Mars and what the process is going on within.
That's right. I mean, that's going to be a really interesting mission for all sorts of reasons, because it's going to do something on Mars that's never really been done on any other planet other than the Earth and the Moon. InSight's going to deposit a seismometer on the surface of Mars, and so we'll be able to sort of detect Mars quakes and use that that information to infer aspects of the interior of Mars that we just can't get by any other means.
And I suppose for understanding the weather on a planet, you need to have a fairly holistic view of what's going on. So do you use the images from the other orbiters and the rovers and so on to great extent, or are those just for context?
So far as my own research is concerned, I've mentioned that we're interested in the weather measurements from Curiosity, but of course that's just measuring one small spot on the surface of Mars, so that's telling us about that particular locality. But the kind of models that we're developing in Oxford and with my colleagues at the Open University and in France and Spain is a global model. So we're very much interested in the global circulation of the Martian atmosphere. And the best way of acquiring information on the global structure and behavior of the atmosphere is to watch it from Mars orbit. So yes, images are certainly one way in which we can get very useful information. So that allows us to image the continually changing clouds in the atmosphere of Mars. There are clouds of both water ice and sometimes carbon dioxide ice that appear from time to time, depending on the seasons, and we can image what they do. And dust storms are another major source of activity in the Martian atmosphere. Most of the surface of Mars is basically a sort of a sandy, rocky desert sort of landscape, much as we would find, sort of, say, in the Sahara Desert or the Gobi Desert or you know, various other places on the Earth's surface. And if it gets windy in the desert, then you can get sand and dust sort of lifted by the wind and forming clouds of suspended dust that can move across the surface, and we certainly see that happening quite often on Mars. And so images are certainly a very, very good way of sort of detecting those and actually watching the evolution of these dust storms for us to compare with our models. But the other major source of information that we get from orbit is that there are also if we look in wavelengths other than in the visible spectrum, if we look in particularly in the infrared, wavelengths that are a bit longer than visible light, then those are wavelengths where the atmosphere is not so transparent because of the effects of spectral lines, particularly due to carbon dioxide and water. And we can use the spectral variations of how opaque the atmosphere is to actually measure the temperature of the planet, the temperature of the atmosphere at different heights. And we can do this directly from orbit without actually going into the atmosphere. And so this is one of the main sources of information that we actually use for our weather models. So we can actually, if you have a satellite that flies over the surface of Mars often enough, then you can actually produce maps of temperature across the atmosphere, both in the horizontal direction and in the vertical. And that provides a very important constraint that we can either compare our models with, or even we're actually recently developed techniques that can actually take those observations and actually ingest them into the model and actually use them as part of the model simulation to determine all sorts of aspects of the properties of the atmosphere.
And of course, in decades to come, the plan is that we'll have people walking around on Mars and various human spaceflight missions that will go there. Is one of the goals of the forecasting not only to understand the atmosphere, but also to be able to help with when maybe the best time is to go to Mars for these things? Presumably, you don't want to land in the middle of a dust storm.
That's right. Yes. Well, in fact, we're already using some of these techniques to provide forecasts for even the unmanned landers, because you know, even landing an unmanned lander in the middle of a major storm or whatever is generally a pretty bad idea. So we can certainly help provide guidance even now to people planning these missions as to you know, what they need to design their spacecraft to be able to cope with. But yes, ultimately we would hope to be able to provide you know, the kind of operational support that we're used to on the Earth for any sort of surface activity.
Well, it sounds fascinating stuff. I look forward to seeing the Martian weather forecasts in years to come, and who knows, they might be useful for some of the listeners who are on those manned missions to Mars in I guess decades to come is more likely for that. Peter Reed from Oxford University, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
And that was Dr. Peter Reed from the University of Oxford there, and I'm joined again by Hugh Lang from Cardiff University.
Hello, Chris.
Now, at the start, I said Mars has been in the news for two reasons. The first being this comet that went flying past.
That's right, comet sighting Brilliant Springs.
Yeah, so that went flinging past, and the Mars orbiters were safe. They hid behind Mars.
They did.
not much to see from here unless you had a small telescope.
Well, the problem with Mars is that it's very low in the south at the moment, so there's a lot of atmospheric murk, and it's certainly not really close enough to see any real detail. So, unfortunately, Mars is... Well, it's a hanger-on, in actual fact. It is around its low in a south sky, and the only thing about Mars that's interesting at the moment is that it's going to be close to globular cluster M28 on the 6th of November.
Okay, so if you've got clear skies just after dusk, and you've got a clear western horizon...
And it will be just after dusk. Yeah. It'll be very close to dusk.
Then try and have a look. If you want pictures of a comet going past Mars, there are some great ones available on the internet. So I'm sure if you search for that Mars and comet sighting spring, you'll find some. In terms of other planets, there's not a lot around at the moment, but Mercury's there.
Yes, it reaches its greatest elongation, which means furthest from the Sun, on the 1st of November.
And that means it's easiest to see from
here. And it will be, for us, easiest to see, because it's straight up from the Sun. So, principally, you have about an hour before sunrise to see it, and it's quite bright as well. So, you know, through a small telescope, it'll be about half phase. For a pair of binoculars, it'll just look like a bright point of lights. But worth looking at.
So that's you need to look up just before sunrise, just above the
eastern...
About an
hour, just about an hour before sunrise.
Just above the east-southeastern horizon. And then that'll be for this first half of November, and then it'll disappear again, I guess.
That's right, yes, we won't see it until January then.
Further out in the solar system, we've got Jupiter, of course.
Well, of course, star of the sky is back up. I call it a star, it's a planet, really. The planet, the king of the planets, is going to make a wonderful appearance again. At the beginning of November, it'll be rising about late evening, which is about 11:30, 23:30, in the constellation of Leo. It's going to be dazzlingly bright. It's going to be very easy to see. You won't be able to mistake it for a star. And by the end of the month, it'll be about 2 hours earlier, so it'll be rising about 21:40. Of course, then it'll be up all night as well. And of course, for the real observers, those who like to observe it, the best time will be about 3 hours before sunrise. I know it's in the morning, where it'll be at its highest elevation, which will be about 53 degrees on the meridian. So, best time to look for it. I'm sure there'll be plenty of observers out there who'll want to see it.
And this is the start of this current, we call an apparition of Jupiter.
That's correct, yes.
Appearing as Earth goes around its orbit and sort of catches up with Jupiter. And one of the interesting things to see this time around will be, has the great red spot continued to shrink?
That's right. You know, the last 20 years, it's slowly fading away, literally. Yeah. The colour is changing. Of course, there's lots of other things to look at. Of course, there's the four Galilean moons, which you can see with binoculars, of course, so it's well worth looking with binoculars. And of course, the dark equatorial belts really do stand out, so well worth looking at. Of course, if you look very carefully with the telescope, you can see it's slightly flattened on the poles, simply due to its rapid rotation.
Lots to see with Jupiter, certainly. The other planets aren't really on show, but we might get a useful signpost for Uranus on the 4th of November.
That's right, the Moon is going to help here for the first time. For anybody who really wants to look at Uranus and never seen it before, this is an ideal time to look for it. Yeah, so you really want to look about twilight, okay? So if you start about 5 o'clock in the evening or 1700, okay, it will be fairly close. So with a pair of binoculars, you should be able to pick up the Moon, which will be a fairly thin phase, okay, and...
So a thin crescent.
Yeah, thin crescent, okay, and the planet. And you'll see that in binoculars. And the beauty of Uranus is that it'll look distinctly green, so it'll look unusually non-star-like due to its colour. At about half past five, it's going to be about 6 arc minutes away from the southern edge of the Moon, okay? So you should be able to pick it up quite easily then. It will be really noticeable. And, of course, as the Moon passes it and moves away, it should become really distinctive on itself as a green dot of light. With binoculars, you're not going to see any more than a green dot of light, unfortunately. And even with a reasonable-sized telescope, where it's a fairly small diameter, it might look like a very small greenish disc.
So you need a big telescope to see the disc of Uranus.
You would need a big telescope, yes.
But if you've never seen it before, this is the chance to go out and know where to find it.
I think it's the best time. If you've never seen it before, at least if you look at the Moon and never actually see it, but you might see some dots around, you can turn around and say, well, I saw the Moon and I'm bound to see Uranus as well. So you could tick it off your observing list.
Excellent. And then I guess we should finish with some upcoming meteor showers.
Yes, there's the annual tour of meteor shower, which has a weak peak on the 5th, the 6th of November. It's not a great shower, but the beauty of the torrid meteor showers is the slow-moving meteors, okay, and it does produce fireballs, so you can get one or two really dazzlingly bright objects shooting across the sky, and for that reason alone it's well worth looking at. But the best one will be the Leonid meteor shower, which the peak will occur on the 15th, and between the 15th and 20th of November. The peak will actually occur on the 17th, 18th of November. We may see 20 to 30 metres an hour.
So plenty to look forward to. Until next month, Hugh, thanks very much.
Yes, bye, Chris.